Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local and innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, it migrates to the air via the signals of this lovely station and our growing number of affiliates, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where I posted this morning a blog entry on idealism, transcendental idealism in particular.
Hey, that's great, Ken. You know, I haven't read it yet, but I'm sure it'll be fascinating. Now, Kant was often called an idealist. He claimed he wasn't an idealist, but he did, whether he was an idealist or not, he did kind of put this question center stage, that has remained center stage in philosophy ever since. To what extent is our mind, or in more recent time, our mind and especially language, responsible for the world, for that which we think of as the world? Is it largely our construction, or is it something, as was thought before Kant, that was largely independent of us?
Well, Kant certainly thought it was largely our construction. You put it, a joint product of the noumenal world about which we can't know anything, and our own kind of creative powers of mind. And I think it's a really cool idea. I think it's a really, really important idea. But, you know, one of the problems, though, that this world that we create for Kant is just kind of matter in motion kind of thing. It's just like this Newtonian spatial-temporal order of matter relentlessly changing and coming to be and passing away. There's no freedom. There's no self in it. So it's kind of a limited world that we create.
I think Kant's got kind of a fascinating idea that there's this real world out there, but that all we're really aware of is something that's filtered through our own human capacities and so forth. But there is a problem, it seems to me, is that where are we in it? If we're part of this joint product between us and the real world, then we must have been in this, we must have been causing the real world with it.
Yeah,
so
because
we must not be in the real world.
Well, yeah, he talks about...
I'm in the phenomenal world, aren't I? I mean, where am I?
You're a pretty phenomenal guy, John. Yeah. But in some sense, you're kind of in the phenomenal world and you're also in the noumenal world. It's kind of a really complicated view, but you're right, though. We create it. We are the, with the noumena, we create this thing, what he calls the spontaneity of the intellect, the spontaneous power of the intellect. But it's really hard because, you know, freedom and all that stuff, it's really hard to fit it into that phenomenon. Yeah,
if we're both producer and product, how are we as moral agents supposed to think of ourselves? I mean, if we're not part of the world of space and time, how can we act? But if we can't act, how can we be moral?
You know, to answer that question, you have to read Kant's three critiques, the Critique of Pure Reason, the Critique of Practical Reason, and the Critique of Judgment. But we'll try to deal with it in 45 minutes, in the 45 minutes remaining on the show. And to help us think about Kant's idea, Polly Stryker, our roving philosophical reporter, went out and talked to some people about how Kant's ideas affect us in the 21st century. She files this report.
Immanuel Kant had many big ideas. So many, in fact, that it's hard to know where to focus. Stanford philosophy professor Alan Wood is a noted Kant scholar. He believes one of Kant's ideas identifies a universal desire for satisfaction, a goal that can never be achieved.
The human condition for Kant is a problematic one, and it's not one that we can feel ever entirely comfortable with. The way I put it is that it's our fate as rational beings to seek a completeness and final satisfaction in a system of knowledge and belief, but it's also our fate that our own honesty as rational beings must always deprive us of the satisfaction we are bound to seek.
What better place to ask about satisfaction in life than at a large party?
I think that true satisfaction is possible in my life, or in anybody's life. I think it all has to do with how you view yourself, first of all. Somebody might say that being successful at work would be at the top of where they're going. Other people would say, just as long as my work is respected by others, as long as I get critical acclaim, then that's fine as well. But I do think it's reachable and it's attainable.
There's a certain amount of stress on our bodies so that we stand upright and fight gravity. And I think there's a certain amount of stress on our psyche so that we can be happy. We have to fight the forces that pull us down. It's both incomplete to say that I am happy and satisfied, but it's also incomplete to say you cannot be happy and satisfied. It's a cycle, it's a continuum.
Satisfaction is completely attainable. The problem is that it tends not to last very long. So we have many moments in our lifetime of satisfaction and fulfillment, but then they're gone. And that constant drive, that need to have fulfillment and happiness again, forces us to look for the next moment. I actually think our need to strive for fulfillment is a positive thing, but like anything else, it needs to be held in balance, generally with an ability to recognize the beauty of the moment, to live in the now. That helps to offset that constant need to do more, to achieve more, to have new experiences. I'm a happy person as it is, but I think I've trained myself to become that way because I didn't start out happy. What makes me happy might not make Immanuel Kant happy, but, you know, then that's his prerogative to define happiness for himself.
Well, I disagree completely with the fact that he says that there's if you tell yourself you're happy, then that's just an illusion. I mean, you could say the same thing the other way. Well, if you say you're unhappy, then that's also just an illusion.
You can't reach full, complete, total happiness. You can't reach the limit. You can't reach the maximum. You can only strive for it. Oh, you should keep striving for it. Why? What else would you do? If striving for it is better than not striving for it, but you have to understand that you'll never get there. Never, ever, ever. You can't. Kant was right, completely right, totally right, absolutely right.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly Stryker, for that piece. Alan Wood gave us some insights about Kant, and people at a party helped us understand how difficult it is to understand Kant.
I can't quite say that those people at the party really understood Kant, but that's another thing.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest today is Peter Gilgan, who joins us from the ETV audio studios at Cornell University, where he's an assistant professor in the Department of German Studies there. He's author or editor of the upcoming book, Lekturen der Erinnerung, Lessing, Kant, and Hegel. Peter, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, Ken, and hi, John. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Oh, Peter, it's good to talk to you again. Now, Kant famously said that he was awakened from his dogmatic slumbers by reading the works of David Hume. Just as an aside, right. J.L. Austin famously said, it's sometimes better to leave sleeping dogmatists lie. But putting Austin aside, what was Kant talking about when he talks about his dogmatic slumbers? And exactly what did Hume say that woke him up?
Well, I mean, the problem for Kant was that living in the mid-18th century, the prevalent philosophy in German lands, and we should be clear on this too, that there was no united Germany, which is important later on when we talk about maybe Kant's relation to political figures and religious figures. Basically, there was a type of rationalism which built up on, let's say, relatively standard metaphysical notions like God and the existence of the soul and so on, and had built very meticulous systems, the big master having been Leibniz, and then after him, Wolff and Baumgarten, whose textbooks Kant was to use throughout his life as a professor, actually, were the followers of this approach. And it seemed, to a certain extent, all right. But then when Kant encountered Hume and Humean skepticism, where Hume really asked, what exactly can we know of all this stuff, and decided that not very much was left that we really could know, that these were figments of the imagination.
So let me check that I understand it. So Leibniz and Wolff and those guys were rationalists who thought
with our reason
we could figure out a lot of stuff. And then
right, they thought that... Right.
Kant's big book is The Critique of Pure Reason. So he's critiquing them, right? And so that's he must be an empiricist then, is that right?
Well, not quite. He's trying to take the middle road between the two. And in a way, he thinks that Hume cannot be right either, because if Hume were right, then basically our fate, at least in Kant's eyes, would be a pretty sorry fate, and we couldn't know very much at all, and would also have not very much to say about, for example, such important things as our morality, what we should do, because in Hume's view, we were determined mostly by our passions, and reason would only work as a sort of... rationalization for our passions, whereas that was an unacceptable approach for Kant.
Let me see if I got you right. So you said something about our faith, right? Would be, I mean, The rationalists.
Our fate, I mean.
Our fate. Okay, good, good. Because Kant has this strange quotation. He denies knowledge. He limits knowledge to make room for faith. I thought you
That's
were.
That's right.
But so the rationalists believe in all this cool stuff and the power of reason to know this cool stuff about, you know, the inner animating causes of the world, of nature, right? I mean, they thought they could know by reason, as it were, the complete system of nature. And you can know the self, and you can know God, and all this cool stuff just by the power of reason. And I guess Hume the empiricist, we've talked about Hume a lot on this show, Hume the empiricist said, no way, because all you know is based on the deliverance of your senses, and the senses right. really don't give you very much deep insight into the world, not at all. Right, so was it that thing that, you know, woke Kant from his dogmatic rationalist slumber, agreeing with Hume?
Well, I mean, what Kant noticed in the process was, the other important thinker probably was Newton for him, because he saw how Newton was capable of putting science forward. So there was real progress in science. We suddenly could do much more in physics than we had ever been able to do. And for Kant, the question was, well, why is it not like that in philosophy? What leads philosophers like Hume and Leibniz, let's say, to disagree on such basic principles so profoundly that basically it seems almost like they have nothing in common?
Yeah.
And the question then is, well, isn't there a possibility that we could make philosophy more scientific, put it on a footing that could compare to the footing physics now was on?
Right, and he talks about... He talks about putting metaphysics on, what did he call it, the secure path of a science, kind of.
That's
once
right,
and for
yes.
all, right? Making metaphysics yep. scientific. Right.
So I mean, ordinarily, we would think, I mean, look, in our milieu, we would say, well, our knowledge depends partly on reason because mathematics and logic, you don't have to perform experiments to know those things. So that's reason's role. But on the other hand, everything about the empirical world, whenever you've got something that might have turned out different, like... how fast a bacteria multiplies or something like that, mm-hmm. you have to do experiments and find out. So are we all conscience because we believe that knowledge is a combination of experience and reason?
Well, not quite. I think we would have to talk a little bit more here about how these two things come together. And, I mean, in your introduction, you already alluded to this strange, this strange construction of, on the one hand, having a noumenal world, and on the other hand, having a phenomenal world. And for Kant, I mean, one thing that he really was adamant about, he wanted to save our, let's say, everyday intuitions about the world. To him, that seemed a sort of commonsensical thing that shouldn't be tossed out with the bathwater. So, in opposition to the Humean skepticism, he wanted to make sure that there was something like an empirical realism. However, he combined that with, you've already introduced this notion of transcendental idealism, which means, basically, that in this world we do perceive things, but we can only perceive them the way our senses are made. I mean, the input we get is in some way organized by our senses and our mental faculties, and thereby we create the objects we see out in the world. Now, they may not be like that in quote-unquote reality. I mean, we all have, let's say, green glasses on, and we will never know that we have green glasses on because we can't take them off. The yeah. glasses we have on are the glasses we have on, and what we perceive through them is what we can see.
Peter, I'm going to ask you to expand on that after a short break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is Kant, the philosophy of Immanuel Kant. Our guest is Peter Gilgan from Cornell University.
We've been talking about Kant's place in the history of philosophy, especially his relationship with empiricists like Hume and rationalists like Descartes and Leibniz and Wolff. We're going to dig more into the details of Kant's own strange metaphysics and epistemology.
Noumena, phenomena, and your calls when Philosophy Talk continues.
Talking Heads and Once in a Lifetime. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're discussing the philosophy of Immanuel Kant. Join us. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. Is the world we experience a mere appearance? Can we ever get behind or beneath the appearances of things to see them as they are in themselves? Could the world we experience really be just be a creation of the human mind? You can give us your opinions about these things. You can call us, or you can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. We're talking about Immanuel Kant, and I just want to mention to our listeners that a good introduction to Kant is a book by Alan W. Wood of Stanford University called Kant. And he has another book called Kant's Ethical Theory that pertains to some subjects we're going to hit in a while. So don't really recommend plunging into the Critique of Pure Reason without a little preparation. These books by Alan Wood should do the trick.
Kant is a great thinker, but not a great writer. Our guest is Peter Gilgan from Cornell University. Peter, I want to ask you about this phenomena noumena world. I mean, help me get into the frame of mind of believing in this kind of distinction. Why can't I just say, you know, how the world is? The world is how it seems to me. I mean, there's sometimes when, you know, if I'm drunk or my eye vision is clouded, but if things are working right, the world is, really is, in and of itself, how it seems to me. That's how most of us, I think, approach the world. We seeing is believing, you know, all that. Why not believe that?
Well, for everyday purposes, I think that might be good enough. But if you want to do philosophy, if you want to ask what is the condition of possibility of these appearances, how can we actually have these appearances, then, at least according to Kant, we come to a point where, I mean, first of all, as we already said, we are contributing to these appearances to a large extent because we have, as I said, the green glasses on, which are basically our sensuous capabilities. And with those, we determine how the data that hits on our eyes and our retinas and so on and our ears, that how we organize this data and turn it into quote-unquote objects.
Well, Peter, now, let me try out an idea on you. I'm looking here at a desk. And as a piece of furniture in the everyday world, it seems to me that it's smooth and solid. But we know that really there's a whole different world that's responsible for that appearance of solidity and smoothness, a world of little molecules and atoms that are mostly empty space, and below them, quarks. Now, could I say, oh, well, see, Kant was right. There's this phenomenal world, the one we're used to, of the smooth, solid desk, and then there's the noumenal world, the little molecules underneath. And Kant was only wrong that he thought we couldn't understand the noumenal world, and actually he was right because I don't understand it, but other people do, I gather. How about that point of view?
Well, that's not going far enough because, I mean, for Kant, if you look at his big work, the first critique, the Critique of Pure Reason, it starts out at the very beginning already with space and time. Even space and time, Kant says, we cannot be sure that such a thing really exists.
Oh, my goodness.
It's part of...
Go ahead.
Yeah,
keep going.
It sounds pretty wild, right? Uh-huh. So it's part of how we perceive the world. I mean, time, our sense of time is our inner sense, and we cannot perceive anything but in time. We always, whenever we perceive something, it seems like time is passing. At the same time, when we look outside, I mean, the outer sense is space. Everything we ever perceive, we perceive in space. However, that's not to say that objectively out there, beyond our own perception of the world, there is such a thing as this space or time. And that's, I mean, the problem being, as Kant says at the very beginning of the first critique, reason as our capacity is a very strange thing because it seems to always pose questions that ultimately it cannot really answer, for which it cannot find answers that are, philosophically speaking, satisfactory answers. Yeah. It always exceeds itself, you could say, and that's, by the way, also an answer why perhaps when we come to our practical side, why we can never be fully satisfied, because there is something in us, theoretically as well as practically, that seems to go always further than we're actually capable of going.
So wait a minute. So space and time are, to use some Kantian jargon, ideal. They're nothing kind of independently of us. He calls those things like the form of our sensibility, right? They're the form in which we perceive objects. We always perceive objects as persisting, existing in space and persisting through time, but we bring space and time as like the furniture of our mind somehow. Now, see, I mean, why should I believe that? I mean, that seems so weird, especially space. I mean, space is the way in which things are distinct from me. Things, you know, John's over there. He's not over here. How do I know John's not me? Because he's over there. He's not over here.
So space and time are just your way of keeping things apart and keeping everything from happening at once. That sounds kind of cool. It sounds, though, like we're kind of trapped in a big video game. And we can't get outside. But even with a video game, video games take place in time. I've never been in one that didn't take place in time.
You remember our John, we did a show on time a while back with a physicist, David Albert, and he said he can't figure out any reason to refute the idea that the flow of time is really just the flow of our ideas. It's something subjective, not something objective. I guess Kant is really the founder of that idea that time is just something subjective. Right, Peter? I got that right?
Right. No, absolutely. And I think what is important in that idea, especially if you look at, let's say, the humanities in the modern world, academically speaking, where a certain type of constructivism is very prevalent. It seems to me what is good about Kant is that he acknowledges that there is a certain constructive force to our own being, that we really do create the world not just with our hands, but actually in our perception we contribute a lot that makes the world the world. But at the same time, there is something like, let's say, a sort of resistance out there. It's not as the post-Kantians would have it, Fichte and Schelling and Hegel, that we can just do away with that noumenal side of things and basically have something that initially was called subjective idealism, where the subject, I mean, most pronounced perhaps in Fichte, where the subject would be ultimately the creator of everything.
Right.
And that's something which Kant really wants to avoid.
So I mean, John's metaphor of the world being the world we experience and know being a joint product of our minds and this noumenal world is really right on in Kant. I mean, it's not like it's just us making up the world. There's this,
right.
Yeah. Ronnie in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ronnie.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can.
Oh, good. Shoot. Okay. Well, I just wanted to add something maybe, and then to make sure that I'm on the right track here.
Okay.
Going back to Kant. Kant was awakened, as you say, from his dogmatic slumbers. Okay. And what awakened, as you indicated, waking him from his dogmatic slumbers was David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, writer, thinker. Okay, and what he said was that certain knowledge is not perceived through the senses, but is imposed on man's mind. What he's saying in effect is that we come into the world predisposed to look at things a certain way. In other words, our mind, the cognitive ability, is programmed.
This Hume you're talking about.
Hume, yeah.
Right. Yeah, so Hume said, look, if we didn't come in kind of pre-programmed to assume that the future would be like the past, we would really be up a creek without a paddle.
Yeah, right, Hume said that, but he said we make that assumption without any warrant, without any justice, without any foundation.
So what's your question, Ronnie?
Yeah, what's your call, Ronnie?
Well, no, I was saying, is that pretty much what you guys were saying earlier?
You kind of got us right, Ronnie.
Yeah, that's good, Ronnie. We posed the question, exactly how did Kant think he'd gotten beyond Hume? They both agree that you can't, just on the basis of logic, prove that the future will be like the past. And they both agree you can't just get it out of experience. But Kant thought there was another place he could find it.
And Peter, help us
Ken
understand.
And Peter are going to explain
Peter,
it.
Peter,
help
us
understand
that.
Basically, Kant didn't want to go the rationalist route by saying we have innate ideas. But what we do have is a sort of structure that we have as rational beings. And with the help of this structure, we can put the world together. So it's not quite an innate idea in the sense that we know of God or something like that, as the old-fashioned rationalists would want to have it. But at the same time, it's not exactly either that we just get sense data and then that's all we can know, but rather we have a structure in us that helps us to make sense of the world. For example, and this is, of course, the big point where Kant very strongly disagrees with Hume, the question of causality. Causality for Kant is an objective fact in the phenomenal world, but the phenomenal world is all that we have. And he says we cannot perceive things differently than that, all of us. And in that sense, causality is an objective fact. And it doesn't matter whether Hume tends to think that, well, we just derive it from inductively from certain things we see happening one after the other, but we can never be sure whether that happens the next time too. Well, we can be sure that in the phenomenal world that's going to happen the next time too.
Yeah. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Give us a call. Join this discussion at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Ed in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ed.
Hi, a couple of marvels I've been playing with. Force and work were really important during Newton's time, the Industrial Revolution and all that. Maybe those ideas of force and work that physics are built on are just kind of like cultural things. It sounds sort of like we're talking almost like cultural relativism or deconstructionism. And what does Chomsky have to say? It seems like he comes in here somewhere. I've been praying for my 30-year-old dad recently. I just figured that fits in there somehow, just as an experiment. I don't usually...
Well, some interesting points. Thanks for the call, Ed. I'd say that all of these relativisms, cultural relativism, linguistic relativism, really aren't quite what Kant had in mind, but they're in the stream that he released of things that we know not being just as they are, but having a lot of input from us, our minds, our language, our culture.
Yeah, Peter, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, the problem there is, I think, that what people often totally overlook is that Kant is defined. I mean, he's not talking about psychology here. He's not talking about you are like this because you grew up in this culture and somebody else is different because they grew up in a different culture. That may well be true. So relativism in certain cultural areas may well play a part. But Kant is really talking about what are the conditions of possibility of our experience as human beings, meaning as embodied rational beings. And so a critique that would come in on the part of cultural difference would not even touch on that.
Right.
It's deeper than that.
Right.
And I think that's very important to say.
I think you're right. Give us a call. Join this discussion. 415-841-4134. If you're outside the Bay Area, toll free at 1-800-525-9917. I think you're deeply right about Kant is no kind of relativist, and he thinks there's a kind of universal architecture of mind, of rational minds, and this, you know, these what he calls the categories of cause, substance,
right,
all that
right.
stuff. Any kind of rational mind brings that stuff to its experience. But there's a way to think about how you might be led to relativism of a kind from Kant. Because Kant thinks there's a fixed once-and-for-all architecture, and you might think, well, he's right. The mind has to have some antecedent architecture that it brings to its experience as an organizing thing. But you know what? It can change. It's subject to all kinds of forces. It kind of has a certain plasticity, and then you're off and running with a kind of relativism.
Of course, Kant, although he didn't think you could give rational arguments for the soul and the self and God, thought he could give pretty rational arguments for what he called the structure of categories. Mm-hmm. Those arguments maybe are not quite as persuasive as he thought they were, so people were kind of half convinced. I think we think in terms of categories and construct the world in terms of categories, but I don't think they're just fall out of the nature of understanding. I think they fall out of culture and language. So there is a root from Kant to a lot of these modern trends.
What do you think about that, Peter?
Well, I would agree. I think it's true that from a certain point on, cultural differentiation would certainly play a part, and possibly, let's say, sexual difference might have something to do with it too. And those are certainly points where one could amend Kant. But I think what is important and something that I personally tend to agree with is that at the very basis, there are probably some things, and maybe Kant thought more things than we would nowadays think, but there are some things on which all of our human experience is based, and we have something in common. And I think, quite frankly, in a time where relativism sometimes really does run rampant, I think it cannot be stressed often enough that there is maybe something out there that we all have in common, and that Kant gives a pretty good argument for that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Look, I want to try one last thing at making it plausible and deeply plausible that we've got to bring a whole bunch of stuff to experience, right? We've got to, there's got to be a lot of work for the human mind to do. Because if you think about, what do the senses really do to us? They just tickle our nerve endings. That's all the sense, all, it's all, the world rushes in how? On our nerves, on our nerve endings. And Barclay put it, what light does to the eye is shake the optic nerve. That's all it does, is it's energized shakings. But then outcrops representations of space, time, persistence, cause, effect, right? All this complex stuff. So where does that come from? It doesn't just come from the energized shaking of the nerve endings. It's stuff that we somehow bring to bear that's already in the mind. It's got to be like that. It's got to be right somehow. Don't you guys think that's got to be right?
Well, I think that's right. I'm a little unclear as why it's such a big advance beyond Hume. I mean, Hume says, look, A causes B means in your experience A's have been followed by B's and you've grown to expect it. And the reason for that is custom. And he would base it eventually on the kind of the way that animal spirits race around your mind. Kant says the basis of it is something that is expressed in German and sounds much more important, you know, the categorical structure of the mind. But
Peter, what do you think? Is it, why is it an advance over you in 1 minute?
You know, I mean, first of all, I think it is interesting that that question arises because Hamann, who was a friend of Kant's in Königsberg at that time and did not agree philosophically with Kant, but he used to call Kant our Prussian Hume. I mean, so there was some justification even in contemporary terms of reading Kant as sort of just a bit of an extension, perhaps, of Hume, but more or less falling together in many questions with Hume. I mean, mostly as a skeptic, that would be, you know. Vis-a-vis the rationalists in particular. And so I think it's not entirely wrong to say that Kant has a lot in common with Hume. I mean, the question would be, what Hume are we talking about in that very moment?
Yeah.
To me, that's more the question than what Kant are we talking about, because what is the positive contribution of Hume? And I think there is a lot of room for different interpretations.
But John's point helps us to see why it is that Kant said that it was Hume who woke him from his dogmatic slumber, right?
Right.
Because Hume is the guy who says, look, guys, you silly rationalists. You think the reason just peers into the nature of things. We know the world through our senses, and the senses don't deliver much.
Now, you might want to claim that Hume and Kant are closer than it seems on metaphysics, but I don't think anybody would want to claim they're particularly close on morality, freedom, and things like that.
Yeah,
different directions.
That's
there. So we better get into that.
Yeah, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the philosophy of Immanuel Kant with Cornell University's Peter Gilgan.
Kant's philosophy may seem to leave no room for freedom, the self, morality, or even God, because we don't know those things on the basis of reason, and they don't seem to be elements of direct experience. But Kant claims to limit knowledge in order to make room for faith, and that includes freedom, the self, and morality. In our next segment, we'll talk about how these are supposed to get into Kant's picture.
Freedom, morality, the self, and your calls when Philosophy Talk continues.
That's the Rolling Stones and I'm Free. And wouldn't Immanuel Kant be thrilled to share a program with Mick Jagger and Keith Richards? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the philosophy of Immanuel Kant with Professor Peter Gilgan of Cornell University. So we're going to talk about the self. Where is the self in Kant's story? Is it a mere appearance and subject to causation and the Newtonian laws? Or is it part of the noumenon and therefore unknowable? How do we get freedom into Kant's world, which is the world of experience, is completely deterministic? Give us a call and tell us what you think. If you're puzzled, call in and share your puzzlement with us.
Yeah, if you can find yourself and get it into gear, you can join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us, comments@philosophytalk.org. And just keep in mind that space and time are illusions, so you better have something to say about that.
So one of the things about us, Peter, all of us, we think of ourselves as free beings subject to morality. I think I know that I'm a free being subject to the constraints of morality. But if I get Kant right, I mean, although he wanted to make room for all that stuff, there's no room for it in his phenomenal world, and the noumenal world is unknowable. So where does it come from? Where does this thought of myself as free, as subject to morality, come from?
Yeah, I mean, the question of freedom and where it fits in is certainly one of the real tricky points in Kant's philosophy. As you say, in the phenomenal world where you have what Kant calls this thoroughgoing determination, sort of in the Newtonian sense, you know, that one thing causes the next, causes the next, causes the next, it would look like freedom doesn't fit in very well. But where it does fit in is exactly in from your own, from your first-person perspective as an embodied rational being. That's where your reason comes in, where your practical side, Kant will say, comes in, namely the practical question of morality. And, I mean, what exactly freedom would amount to in Kant, that's very hotly contested. The minimum point would be to say, even if it were an illusion, the fact that we think we are free is sufficient. That would be the minimum we need for some type of morality. Most interpreters would say that Kant means more than that, but it seems to me it's interesting to maybe start with the minimum and say,
the fact that I think that I am free, is he saying that the fact that I think that I am free make me free? Is it that all my freedom consists in the thought of my freedom or something like that?
Well, it would be something like a property dualism in the sense that the same action could be described under two different aspects. On the one hand, you could describe it in a sort of third-person viewpoint as, I mean, your brain hormones going this way or that way, and that triggers something else, and that's why you lift your hand, and that's why you hit somebody, let's say. But, of course, from your point of view, that doesn't look that way. It always will look as if you could have acted differently, even if some cognitive scientists will tell you, no, actually, I think this was clear. You couldn't have acted differently because your serotonin was at that and that level, yeah. And therefore it couldn't have worked.
So there's like two perspectives I can have on myself, a kind of perspective as myself as just one body among other bodies. And from that perspective, I look kind of like determined by anything else. And then there's this internal perspective of subjectivity or something like that. And from that perspective, I feel free or something like that. Is that
right? And that it creates a sort of, you could say, an inner room within that thoroughgoingly determined world, because obviously our freedom is limited within that world, because even if you wanted to, you can never walk through a wall. So to a certain extent, the phenomenal world out there does restrain your options. But at the same time, it is certainly true that we do feel very strongly that we are the originators of certain actions. And in that, originators of actions that don't seem to us as determined beforehand by something else. And as such, we do feel like we're free.
Okay, let me see if I've got it straight. I can't walk through a wall, so I'm pretty sure I can't sum up Kant in a minute. But so Kant starts out as a rationalist, and he wishes it were true. He would be happy if it were true, if we could prove a priori from reason alone, like Leibniz thought we could, that God exists and that we exist and that we're simple and free. But Hume awakes him from his dogmatic slumbers and sees it's not going to work. On the other hand, if the kind of Humean empiricists were right and the world was just this orderly progression of sensations in a deterministic way, that would be extremely depressing because there wouldn't be any room for God or the self or knowledge of those things. But Kant says it's not quite that bad because there is room for those things, because this phenomenal world, this world that Hume was preoccupied with, is partly our construction. And so by throwing about ourselves, we can limit the by knowing that it's partly our product, partly due to the structure of ourselves, we leave room for this other stuff. Now, given Schopenhauer, a later philosopher, says that with our will, we actually know something about the noumenal world. Kant kind of sounds like that. What did Kant really think that through ourselves, through our knowledge of our own will, we were in touch with that one little part of the noumenal world, or is that just Schopenhauer's idea?
Well, Schopenhauer certainly goes further than Kant does. And Schopenhauer's notion of the will, even though Schopenhauer did think that he was sort of a correct interpreter of Kant, I think Kant would have not agreed with. But What Kant did think is that we as rational beings are indeed inhabitants of both worlds in a certain way, and that we do have freedom. And the question of freedom is actually really the crucial point here and the tricky point, because and you see that also in Kant's works, because when he writes the groundwork for the metaphysics of morals, he still thinks that from reason he can derive the moral law, whereas when he writes the 3 years later, when he writes the Critique of Practical Reason, which is basically also on morality, the order has changed. And it's actually the moral law that we feel in us as conscience, yeah, or as when we want to do something but we just know it's not right, that actually indicates to us that we are free.
Yeah, you know, Peter, we're going to have to say goodbye to you, but it's a really fascinating conversation, and we've left ourselves with a big problematic, because I think the encroachment of modern science and more peering into how the brain works really makes us wonder, where is the self? Where is freedom?
Yeah,
and I mean,
true.
So it's a problem Kant left us with. And I'm going to have to say goodbye to you on that note. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Professor Peter Gilgan, who's an assistant professor and director of undergraduate studies in the Department of German Studies at the Cornell University, author of the upcoming book, Lekturen der Erinnerung, Lessing, Kant, and Hegel. So, John, what...
Well, I want to thank all the callers we didn't get to and some emailers that we didn't get to. Some of the emails came in a little after we were discussing the topics. So, Ken, what did we learn today? You knew all about Kant already. Maybe you didn't learn anything.
Kant is a really important philosopher. I think he's, with Hume, kind of the co-founder of the modern era, of the modern problematic. I think, you know, he's a huge fan of science and tries to ground science and all this stuff. I think he's one of the great students of the human mind. I think he saw more deeply into the structure and nature of the human mind and its powers than your buddy Hume by a long shot, John. But he's crazy. Transcendental idealism, the idea that we in some sense make up the world, that's kind of a bastardization. It's crazy. But except for that part, he is deep and amazing.
Well, I mean, there are lots of ways we make up the world. I mean, the world didn't come to us with Pepsi-Cola already in it.
Well, that's true.
And the world didn't come to us with, all the different ways we categorize things, the genres of music. A lot of the ways we see the world are clearly our responsibility. But when you get to space and time, I have a lot of difficulty thinking that space and time aren't something pretty real about the world.
Well, I agree. I think causation and substance and all that stuff is pretty real stuff about the world. And we do need some machinery to be able to find that stuff out through sensation. But I don't think I'd go follow Kant. But still, he's a deep and important guy. But you know what? This conversation continues on our blog, as always, the blog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blago. I think, therefore, I blog. And I've actually blogged a bit on this one. Go check it out, the blog.philosophytalk.org.
Ken, I've got a riddle for you.
Oh, shoot.
When is a drum not a drum?
I know. When it's a conundrum. And we've got a conundrum now. Chris from Connecticut's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Chris.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks, John. Big fan of your show.
Oh, hi, Chris. Good to hear it. Where in Connecticut are you calling from?
I'm calling from Stamford, Connecticut.
A lot of people think that's where Stanford must be.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you do out there in Stamford, Connecticut?
I'm in financial services, and I work with nonprofit healthcare corporations all over the United States.
So what's your conundrum, Chris?
Here's my conundrum. I was wondering, do our moral obligations as human beings sometimes conflict with the obligations of organized religions? You know, is there something morally flawed about organized religions that leads to isolation and conflict? I'm thinking of religious discrimination or the Crusades, terrorism, holy wars in which people actually kill each other.
Well, there's an interesting paradox, or I don't know if it's a paradox, at least it's a tension, it's a contradiction, Hegel might say, in religion. On the one hand, religion is one of the things that is responsible for our having a conscience and a heightened moral awareness. At the same time, some of the same religions often encourage us to do terrible things, like the Crusades, where Mohammedans and Christians axed each other to death, so forth and so on. So religion seems to be a kind of a two-edged institution when it comes to morality.
I think you're into something deep, Chris. I think there's a really deep thing about religion. Because religion says, I am absolutely true. And not only does it say, I am absolutely true, I mean, most religion anyway, Christianity, Islam, I'm not sure about Buddhism and Western Judeo-Christian religion says, I am absolutely true. I am the foundation of absolute morality. Why is there a moral order? Because God spoke it. God commanded it, that thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not do this. Now, religion says, because I'm absolutely true, the entire world order is obligated to bow down to me. Now, we come across people, we have people who have religions with this absolutist thing. They come across people who don't bow down to the dictates of their religion. And what does the religion say? Well, if it's this totalizing, hold the whole world to it, the religion says, hold the whole world to it, despite the world's resistance. And that's what gets you into trouble. If you're Islamic and you think, well, the infidel doesn't respect the dictates of the absolute truth, and I am entitled to hold the whole world to this absolute dictates of morality, that's when all heck breaks loose.
That's true to a certain extent for some religions, but there are at least some forms of Christianity that take the opposite approach, that preach tolerance or say that, you know, don't worry about the unbelievers, just worry about the kingdom of heaven and mind your P's and Q's. So I don't know that it's inevitable that religion teaches intolerance.
Well, I'm not sure that it's inevitable. But what do you do if you believe that the fundamental commandments are of God, from God, and that God commands them to the world, and that you as God's servant have some duty to uphold them? When you find non-belief, when you have violation of the fundamental commandments, what are you supposed to do? Say, ah, well, that's their problem?
Well, there's different approaches. If you're a Mormon and you think that you ought to spend a couple of years when you're in your late teens going out and providing the word to people that don't have it, but you don't really believe in forcing or coercing anybody into it. If you're a Spanish inquisitor, your point of view is much different.
Suppose you're committed to the fundamental liberty of all human beings, and you see persons who are the victims of people who disbelieve that. Right. And no amount of persuasion can get them to see the truth that, you know, what do you do? Just say, oh, well, too bad for those victims. What do you think, Chris?
Well, I'm not sure what I think. I mean, I think that there's a part of you that says, look, when the church, you have a moral conscience and a moral obligation in your own mind. And then maybe there's some balance between your religious obligations and your own sense of your moral obligations.
What I'm trying to figure out is to what extent a religion based on a convictions about what is absolute can be either indifferent or tolerant of violations of those absolute dictates when they see them in the world. Because, I mean, in some ways that sounds like, well, you know, tolerance is good. But in some ways it seems like, well, look, I won't tolerate slavery. But now you look at it the other way. Look at the Islamic fundamentalists. I will not tolerate Western imperialism. I will not tolerate the rape of Muslim lands and Muslim wealth. And my religion tells me, despite the fact that I can't persuade these guys, do them in. You know, so I don't know if it's so escapable.
Well, if you go back to the slavery debate, you find churches and God-fearing people on all sides in the American South. Some of the Southern churches were very much compromised by the institution of slavery. Some of them for years refused to admit that slaves could be Christians. On the other hand, a lot of the impetus for the anti-slavery came from churches in Massachusetts and other parts of the North that were... So I think the church is a mixed bag. It's like the Boy Scouts or universities or philosophy departments or anything else. There's some parts of it that lead to very good things, and other parts of it, since humans are involved, it's not too surprising, lead to bad things.
Yeah, I still think that religion is faced with a kind of paradox in the modern world. Its absolutist nature is kind of uncomfortable with the vast moral diversity that we find in the world. And its edict to, in some ways, hold the world to its absolute dictates is a big source of trouble. But I agree, it's a more complicated thing than that. Well, Chris, I hope we've at least, I know we haven't solved your conundrum, but
well,
I hope
we've taken your mind off the miserable existence in wet Connecticut for a little while.
Yeah.
Well, you have done that in an entertaining way, and I appreciate your thoughts very much.
And Chris, thanks for calling.
Sure.
It's good to talk to you, Guy.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks,
okay.
Chris.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Join us next week when we tackle the question of the existence of God. You know, your thoughts and questions are always welcome. If you have a proof of the existence of God or a disproof of the existence of God, submit it on our website via the comments. We'll take it up on the air next week.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Rujin Shen, Neil Van Leeuwen, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Tempshin, and Debbie Kennedy.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed, as the case may be, in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.